twinkling lights, tattletale elves, and fights over money. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, December 25th. Thanks so much for joining us this Christmas Day. Now, with the turkey and gingerbread stupor behind us, or nearly behind us, we've got the new year just around the corner. And with it, a whole lot of laws and regulations that'll go into effect. Here in California, the state will become the first to say goodbye to the incandescent light bulb, the bulb invented by Thomas Edison more than 130 years ago. California stores will be able to sell through their supplies, but after that, it'll be the more energy-efficient CFLs and LEDs on the shelf. The new bulbs could save a whole lot of money. Marketplace's Rima Crace reports.
Even if you live in California, there is a good chance you knew nothing about these new standards set to kick in on January 1st.
Regulations often are kind of dry. They're not typically things that people read for pleasure.
Unless you're California Energy Commissioner Andrew McAllister. He says the new regulations mean that retailers should stock their shelves with bulbs that deliver at least 45 lumens per watt. Translation, they've got to be roughly three times more energy efficient than the old incandescent bulb.
It's safer, or you're producing less heat.
A lot less heat, says Noah Horowitz, a scientist at the nonprofit Natural Resources Defense Council.
Incandescents are so inefficient, 90% of the energy they use goes to waste heat. That's why you burn yourself when you touch them.
Instead, Horowitz says people will choose between compact fluorescent lights and LEDs. LED bulbs, he says, can last for more than a decade, saving Californians a total of $1 billion a year in electricity costs.
And on a consumer level, we're going to save $50 to $150 over the life of these bulbs for each bulb in their home.
The rest of the country is expected to catch up to California by 2020. That's because of a 2007 energy bill that's been phasing out inefficient light bulbs nationwide. Mark Lean is with the Illuminating Engineering Society. He says some in the lighting industry are resistant to the phase out, arguing that consumers deserve more choice. But he says with more competitive prices for LED bulbs,
the marketplace is already making the move and the shift. In some cases, standards aren't driving it anymore. The market's driving the standard.
California retailers will be allowed to sell the incandescents they have until they're all gone. Then it'll be lights out for those bulbs. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
The new tax bill, signed into law last week, includes a provision that will allow oil and gas exploration in part of Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Congress says the sale of the new drilling leases could generate more than $1 billion in revenue over the next decade. The move effectively lifts a nearly 40-year-old ban on energy development in the area. And it's a change energy companies and some Alaskans have been lobbying for a long time. But actually, drilling in the refuge could be a risky business proposition. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports.
How much industry interest is there in the refuge, really? Pavel Malchinov is an energy analyst at Raymond James.
The short answer is not much interest. This is an area that's, by definition, unexplored.
Most big oil and gas companies don't operate in Alaska. Malchinov says those that do, like ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips, would be best positioned to drill in the refuge. But even those big players are still many years away from getting oil out of the ground. Step one would be to conduct new geological studies to figure out how much is there. Allison Walters is an oil industry analyst at Wood Mackenzie.
There are companies that could be very interested, but they're going to have the balance sheet to handle the amount of risk and the long timeline.
Those risks could include strict environmental reviews and the possibility of lawsuits every step of the way. The United States Geological Survey estimates there are anywhere from 7 to 17 billion barrels of recoverable oil in the area. Cara Moriarty is president of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
It's a potential giant. That differentiates it from other areas in the United States.
But those other areas aren't nearly as controversial. And the shale boom in Texas and North Dakota has changed the outlook for drilling in the refuge, says Jason Bordoff at Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy.
There's such a large new prolific source of oil supply in the lower 48 that works economically even at today's low oil prices.
Energy companies must also weigh the risk of a new administration coming into the White House down the road that could put the longtime ban on energy development in the refuge back in place. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
The markets were closed today for the Christmas holiday, so instead, we'll have the numbers behind charitable giving. No secret that a lot of things in politics, like the tax bill we just mentioned, like regulations, are influenced by lobbying from professional groups and sometimes from regular people. How that process works is part of what Chrissy Clark from our Wealth and Poverty Desk is exploring in the new season of Marketplace's documentary podcast, The Uncertain Hour. Today, Chrissy brings us the story behind a single regulation of peanut butter.
In the 1950s, the peanut butter industry was dominated by two brands that are still household names.
Like the man says, you like peanuts, you like Skippy.
Skippy and
Peter Pan peanut butter is so grand, smoothest peanut butter in the land.
Peter Pan. And in fact, smoothness was the secret to both these brands' success. Food chemists had figured out that if you pumped hydrogen molecules into some of the peanut oil in peanut butter, turned it into hydrogenated oil, you could keep it from separating out of the peanut butter and make the product way more smooth and spreadable than the old-fashioned kind. But in 1958, a new brand with a little colorful kangaroo mascot hopped into town.
There's a great big peanut paste in Jif.
What changes things is then along comes Jif.
Angie Boyce is a researcher in bioethics at Johns Hopkins University, and she says, sure, new peanut butter brands were showing up all the time back then, but Jif's entry onto the scene was different for a couple reasons. It was, at the time, made by Procter & Gamble, one of the biggest companies around, and there was this rumor that started going through the peanut butter industry about Jif. No one's quite sure where the rumor came from. Maybe a company spy? Industrial espionage around peanut butter was actually really common in the 50s. Or maybe the rumor was just gleaned from rival companies carefully inspecting Jif's peanut butter.
You know, peanut butter manufacturers have a lot of expertise in their product. So maybe through being able to taste the peanut butter and its sensory qualities, what in the industry they would call its organoleptic qualities, they might have been suspicious.
What word was that? Organoleptic?
Organoleptic.
But somehow, through organoleptics or spying, there was this whispering going around that, wait a minute, Jif's peanut butter feels a little too smooth, a little too spreadable. Like, what's in this peanut butter anyway? And just as important, what's not in this peanut butter? Which is when something comes across the desk of an enforcement official at the Food and Drug Administration.
This was just a very brief memo.
Angie is one of the few people still alive who's actually seen this memo. She showed it to me when we went to the National Archives together to look through the FDA's peanut butter files. The memo starts,
"In accordance with our conversation, I am referring this peanut butter file to you. We have had at least two complaints from other manufacturers of peanut butter about the addition of foreign ingredients to peanut butter."
Complaints about foreign ingredients in one brand in particular.
Jif, put out by Procter & Gamble.
But what sorts of foreign ingredients? The FDA did a little detective work itself.
FDA had gone in and an inspector had been doing some inspections.
That's FDA historian Suzanne Junod. She says inspectors went snooping around the Procter & Gamble peanut butter factory in Lexington, Kentucky for 3 days. And when those inspectors reported back, they had some intriguing news. According to Jif's own factory formula, like the kind that might be typed up and hanging on the factory wall, at the time, Jif peanut butter was only made of
75% peanuts.
Only 75% peanuts, but also, for texture, up to 20% something else.
Crisco.
Crisco base.
Crisco. You know, the white stuff that people use to grease pie pans. So yeah, smooth and spreadable, but as Angie Boyce of Johns Hopkins points out,
one would assume that customers would not find Crisco in their peanut butter as acceptable.
Or maybe they'd be okay with it. FDA officials started asking themselves, is a jar of brown paste that's made of only 75% peanuts really peanut butter? If not, how many peanuts should peanut butter have? And what about that 20% Crisco? Crisco was, after all, just a form of hydrogenated oil, not peanut oil like the other peanut butter brands used, but a mixture of cheaper oils from rapeseeds and cottonseeds and soybeans. Would consumers care? Here's the FDA's Suzanne Junot again.
The question, of course, is where's the dividing line between frank adulteration with cheaper ingredients and a legitimate product for which the consumer has shown support?
Because that's part of the FDA's job, as required by law, by Congress, to create regulations that promote honesty and fair dealing in the interest of consumers. So in this situation, what is fair? That answer was clear for at least one consumer, a housewife-turned-activist named Ruth Desmond, who had recently co-founded the Federation of Homemakers. When Ruth heard about how many chemical additives, how much non-peanut stuff was going into many peanut butter brands at the time, Jif and Skippy and Peter Pan, she was shocked. Ruth died several years ago, but her daughter, Janet Swager, remembers coming home from high school one day and her mom telling her,
"Can you imagine that these scoundrels are trying to pass cold cream off as peanut butter?"
Cold cream, that old-fashioned white goopy makeup remover. Janet says that became Ruth's nickname for all the hydrogenated oils.
She said, "That's terrible. They want to make money, industry, by putting less and less peanuts in the peanut butter." And like she said, it's children that are eating these peanut butter sandwiches mostly. And here they're trying to put cold cream in there and use less peanuts.
Ruth thought peanut butter should be at least 95% peanuts. And she started a letter writing campaign. Almost 2,000 people from all over the country sent comments into the FDA. Those letters are also now stored in the FDA's peanut butter files.
"I understand there is some controversy over how many peanuts should be in peanut butter. Let's have plenty of peanuts and peanut butter."
Some are typed, some handwritten. One person sent in a telegram.
"That just says, 100% peanut butter, please, please, please. It's an important food for children. We would like the protection of the regulatory agency in our interests."
And as these letters poured into the FDA, it was clear that the battle over what makes peanut butter, was on.
You can hear the rest of Chrissy's story and what the FDA decided was the appropriate percentage of peanuts in peanut butter. Take a listen to our Uncertain Hour podcast. You can subscribe wherever it is you get your podcasts. Coming up?
Well, the penny really came into use in the mid-8th century.
So can you get anything for just a penny these days? But first, let's do the numbers. It's Christmas Day, so most markets around the world are closed. In the spirit of the holiday, we've got a look at charitable giving. First, the big picture. The Urban Institute, which tracks donations, says Americans spend about 2% of GDP on charities. But the ways we give are changing. Take Bitcoin. The cryptocurrency is growing more and more popular as a way to make donations. That's according to Fidelity Charitable, which accepts the digital currency. Folks donated $22 million worth of Bitcoin through December of this year. Overall, the growth of giving has moderated. A MasterCard report on donations based on the company's credit card transactions found total year-over-year donations through June grew by about 4.3% in 2017. That's a slower pace than 2016. This is Marketplace.
When it comes to news about the economy, Marketplace has got you covered. And when you donate $10 a month or more to support the work we do, you can get a Marketplace umbrella to help protect you from stormy weather. The real benefit of giving comes when you listen every day, knowing that you're making it possible for Marketplace to help people understand the economy and the financial forces that govern our lives. It's important work that we're already doing, and with your help, we'll be able to do more of it and reach more people as well. Become a Marketplace investor today at marketplace.org, and thanks.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. If you've got a kid or grandkid, you might be familiar with Elf on the Shelf. For those of you who have no idea what I'm talking about, here are the basics. The Elf on the Shelf is an elf who hides in different places around the house during the day and flies back to Santa at night to let him know who's been naughty and who's been nice. Millions of elves and accompanying books have been sold since 2005, when the story and a business was co-created by Shanda Bell, her sister Krista Pitts, and their mother, Carol Ebersold. We invited Shanda in to talk about the Elf on the Shelf a few Christmases back.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited about it.
Tell me a little about the tradition in your family. Where did it come from?
Well, when I was growing up, my mom used to tell us that Santa had sent this elf that used to watch and report to Santa. My sister and my brother, we used to race each other out of bed to be the first to find the elf. You know, as you get older and you reminisce and you figure out the traditions that mean so much to you, this is one that for our entire family just stood out as something so special.
And why did you decide to turn a family tradition into a business?
It's so funny when I get that question, because there really wasn't any plan to turn it into a business at all. We grew up with this tradition, and my mom and I were sitting down and having tea one day, and I looked up and I saw our elf sitting on her shelf. And I said, Mom, we should write a book about the elf. And at the time, my mom was going through a really difficult, hard time. You know, empty nest syndrome. She'd been a very active stay-at-home mom. Now all of us were grown and gone. And it really was out of a notion to do something fun together, something that would get her mind off of, you know, current circumstances and be excited about us, you know, still doing something together. And so we crafted the story over, I'm going to say, between 6 and 8 months, of course, with Santa's permission, you know, to share his story. And so we set out on this journey having no idea what we were getting into, no money, no experience, but really believed in this tradition that we were sharing and knew that it would mean a lot to families.
And I understand you guys self-published initially. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, that term self-published, it's sort of comical, because if your goal really is to sell books, you really are opening a publishing company. I mean, really and truly. And so, yes, we did self-publish, and we're actually under that guise, we're still self-published. You know, we still publish all our own books and our work. So we did start our own publishing company, CCA&B, or Creatively Classic Activities and Books.
Now, you said earlier that there was no money to do this. So how'd you guys pursue it?
So in essence, we did not have literally two pennies. I remember this was at a stage in my own life personally where I was a stay-at-home mom and my husband's a school teacher. And my budget for every 2 weeks at the grocery store with diapers and formula was $150 every 2 weeks. And so there really was no money from anywhere. But what my husband and I did have was good credit. And of course, no bank was going to loan to a bunch of, you know, stay-at-home moms with, you know,
with an idea and a dream.
Yeah, with an idea. And so we ended up actually opening our first initial order of 5,000 units, and we used personal credit cards to pay for it. My sister had sold her house in Pennsylvania at the time and was ready to move back to Georgia and, you know, made a little money on that, helped put that towards the first 5,000 books. And then my parents had a very small little retirement account and they cleared that out. And so between the three of us, we were able to cobble up enough just to put this first 5,000 units out there into the universe. You know, looking back, I think it was absolutely the right plan for us. I'm not sure if a traditional publishing house had gotten this tradition that it would have the success that it is. And I'm not sure the book market would have known what to do with it. So I think it really was the passion behind the tradition that helped grow it organically.
I've read some criticism out there that Elf on the Shelf sort of gets children used to being spied on. And I wonder how you address that criticism.
I say take it up with Santa Claus. I mean, the idea that, you know, that Santa knows who's naughty or nice or, you know, what children are doing has been around literally for 100 years. That is not something that we created or invented. And I also think it's how someone presents this to a child. You know, just like you write letters to Santa, this elf takes messages back. It's about the fun and the excitement of the holidays. And I don't know. I think we as grown-ups just take it all too seriously sometimes and try to make something far more out of it than it is.
Shanda Bell is co-creator of Elf on the Shelf. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This was just such a treat. Merry Christmas, everybody.
The penny. Here in the U.S., the coin is a source of great debate. Do you keep it? Do you dump it? And we're not the only ones rethinking the value or lack of value of the penny. The BBC's Elizabeth Hodson has more from London.
The humble penny is the smallest denomination of currency you can get in the UK, and there are calls to get rid of it. Around the world, the penny and its equivalent, the 1 cent piece, has been scrapped in many countries, including Australia, New Zealand and Canada. This is what Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, said last year about scrapping the coin.
We keep inflation low, stable, predictable. What Parliament tells us to do is to make sure it averages about 2% a year. Over time, that means the value of a penny, the real value, what a penny can buy, goes down. And so at some point it does make sense.
Scrapping the penny is controversial, in part because of its long history. For more than 1,000 years, it's been an integral part of the UK economy, and nowadays, rare examples are worth fortunes in themselves.
My name's Christopher Webb of Dixon & Webb, the coin and medal auctioneers. We're specialist auctioneers in numismatics, collecting of coins, and we sell early English pennies.
We're surrounded by drawers and boxes with, I'm guessing, thousands upon thousands of coins.
Indeed, there are, yes. In this room, there's probably 20, 30,000 coins, I should think.
What is the history of the penny? How old is the penny?
Well, the penny really came into use in the mid-8th century, and it was 1/240th of a pound.
Back in the 8th century, how much would a penny have actually been worth?
It was solid silver. I suspect it was quite a lot of money, the equivalent of £50, I'm guessing.
So a penny was worth around $60 or $70?
Yeah.
Outside the realms of rare coins, there's an increasingly vocal lobby to banish the penny. Georgie Frost is a consumer journalist who works with companies like comparison website Go Compare.
I don't think we do need 1 and 2p coins. I think it's absolutely time for them to go. There are concerns retailers would raise prices. They would round up to the nearest, say, 5p. But actually, if you look at the model in Australia and New Zealand, where they both phased out their smaller coins, the shops actually rounded down.
Another argument against keeping the penny is that they're expensive to make. But is that true? Chris Barker is assistant curator of the Royal Mint Museum.
We never sort of give out details regarding the actual cost of producing coins, but, you know, what we can say is that it costs less than the face value of a coin to make a coin.
So it costs less than a penny to make a penny?
Yeah, I mean, the taxpayer is not footing a huge bill in order to make pennies. You know, we work on a financial sense basis in the sense that if you start to make coins which cost more than their face value, then in some ways, what is the point?
Critics of the penny, however, are unlikely to be convinced. Back to Georgie Frost.
Lots of research at the moment shows that we consider them so worthless, especially young people, that we're actually chucking them in the bin, can you believe? Apart from making wishes and bringing you luck, I have to ask, when was the last time you actually bought anything for one pence? Not even penny sweets are a penny. We're going in a direction that is increasingly cashless.
I reluctantly went to test this claim at a sweet shop in London's Covent Garden. A few years ago, you could walk into a sweet shop like this and there'd be a selection of penny sweets. Can I buy anything for one penny?
For one penny, I'm afraid you can't buy anything anymore. It's all done by 100 grams.
How much would one foam fried egg cost me?
6p.
Do people ever come in asking for penny sweets?
They still ask us and we're like, oh, it's not a penny anymore, you know.
That report from the BBC's Elizabeth Hodson in London. This final note before we go today. Around the country, there's a discussion going on among librarians about whether or not libraries should charge late fees, whether those pennies and dimes and quarters add up and become a barrier that stop people from reading, or if fines help remind people to be more responsible borrowers. The LA Times report, Los Angeles County just came down on the no fine side of things, at least for kids and young adults. It's eliminated late fines at county libraries for everyone under the age of 21. So if they happen to keep that stack of books a little longer than they were supposed to, they're not going to wind up with a suspended account. Most world markets were closed today to celebrate the Christmas holiday. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Haley Hirschman, and Daisy Palacios. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Adrienne Hill. We'll see you here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.